this planet, we're going to have wipeout.
Well, I think sometimes there might be a few people that are serious about an ethical foreign policy, but then most politicians aren't. Mostly it's about courting favour with countries that are going to buy lots of weapons from us, like Saudi Arabia.
We don't really have an independent foreign policy. We don't have an independent nuclear deterrent, and as Oliver was saying about turning the, about giving people arms, of course you could turn them off. That could be one way. You could have a code to turn it off remotely, and of course that's what is the case with Trident. And if Britain doesn't follow American foreign policy initiatives, then presumably they'll turn the nukes off. So I'm not sure if Britain even has a foreign policy per se. Also, governments left and right over the past 50 years or so have exported all of our industry to China. And that's not something that can be held as part of the Labour Party policy or part of Tory Party policy. It's part of the whole political class's policy. And so, as I mentioned before, is it strategically wise to have all of your industry exported across the world in sustainability terms or in defence terms?
Well, when you see so many people in government with their hands in the pockets of the coffers of these huge companies, look at Theresa May's husband, Philip May, benefiting massively from the decisions that she helped push through to bomb in Syria. The shares of those companies went up hundreds and probably thousands of percent during the wars. And when the government's in bed with the arms dealers, it just says it all.
I mean, they're selling arms to countries such as Saudi Arabia. They are trying to build a new coal mine in the middle of the climate crisis. They just dropped climate requirements from a trade deal with Australia. They are not serious at all. They are talking the talk, but they are not walking the walk.
The issue is, we've started to see these weapons used against us. Of course, England had and Great Britain has been leading this kind of way of war, the military-industrial complex, the stealing, the colonialism. A lot of the issues we see in the world are reactionary. So I totally agree with what Vivian just said, which is that we actually need to lead by example. If not us, the fact is it's the power of the people as well. We're talking about a minority, which has got the money and are making these things happen. The people, the majority, no, this isn't right, and we will work against it. So I say Great Britain leads the way and stands by their human rights, we the good guys narrative that they've tried to portray for so long.
In my opinion, they don't seem to care about people's welfare, people's beings. All they care about is making money off the blood of other people. So they're happy to allow other countries to fall, other countries to terrorise people. A classic example, Afghanistan, in the last couple of weeks. They knew what was going to happen. Yeah, yet they let it happen because they knew that the Taliban would be in power. They need weapons. Oh, look, hang on a minute. You've done that. Let's send you some more weapons so you can go and terrorize your own people. And other countries like whatever, they help that.
The United Kingdom has once again hosted one of the world's largest and most lucrative arms fairs. Many of the prime customers turn out to be the self-same nations that the UK attacks politically, and sometimes militarily, for their record in terms of human rights abuses and for other policy reasons. Meanwhile, companies like BAE Systems promote their bombs, fighter jets and tanks as battlefield tested.
For many, the arms trade and the billions of pounds of revenue this represents in UK business is public evidence that Britain cares more about money than it does about peace. Selling weapons to nations that Britain itself condemns suggests to critics a clear choice between money versus morals, namely that the British government will enthusiastically promote its arms trade, even if this means putting the benefit of a financial killing above the cost of the human killing for which this arms trade equips the world.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The House Select Committee investigating the deadly assault on the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January is prepared to urge federal prosecution of former aides to Donald Trump, who refused to comply with subpoenas, according to a key member of the panel. Former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, former Deputy Chief of Staff Dan Scavino, strategist Steve Bannon, and Pentagon aide Kash Patel are all defying subpoenas for documents and testimony under instruction from the former president, Donald Trump. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, House Capitol Attack Panel Ready to Urge Prosecution of Trump Aides, says Schiff. Select Committee investigating the deadly assault on the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January is prepared to urge federal prosecution of former aides to Donald Trump, who refused to comply with subpoenas, according to a key member of the panel. Former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, former Deputy Chief of Staff Dan Scavino, strategist Steve Bannon, and Pentagon aide Kash Patel are all defying subpoenas for documents and testimony under instruction from the former president, Donald Trump. Amid fears that the panel will not seek to enforce its will, Adam Schiff, a member of the panel, as well as the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, spoke to CBS's Face the Nation program on Sunday, 10th of October. The 6th of January committee, the California congressman said, wants to make sure that these witnesses come in and testify, and we are prepared to go forward and urge the Justice Department to criminally prosecute anyone who does not do their lawful duty. Liz Cheney of Wyoming, one of only two Republicans on the committee, has also said it will enforce subpoenas. Adam Schiff also greeted a decision by the Biden administration not to invoke executive privilege over documents pertaining to the Capitol attack. The riot, around which five people, including a police officer, died, followed a rally near the White House at which Donald Trump exhorted his followers to fight like hell to overturn his election defeat. Adam Schiff, a key member of the investigating panel, said he hoped the House committee would see such materials very soon. "I applaud the Biden administration for not asserting executive privilege," he said. "Not trying because it's protecting its own prerogative to deprive the American people of the full facts. So hats off to the Biden administration. We should, I think, get those documents soon because the sitting president has the primary say on executive privilege." Friday, 8th of October, in a letter announcing their client's decision not to comply with his subpoena, attorneys for Steve Bannon attempted to assert executive privilege themselves. Observers pointed out that executive privilege applies to communications involving the president the White House wishes to keep confidential. But though Donald Trump was in power on 6th of January, Steve Bannon was not working for him. Trump repeated the lies about electoral fraud which fueled the attack at a rally in Des Moines, Iowa on Saturday, 9th of October. Two senior Republicans, Senator Chuck Grassley and Governor Kim Reynolds, stood with him at the Des Moines, Iowa rally. Referring to a Senate Judiciary Committee majority report this week about how Donald Trump pressured his acting attorney general before the Capitol attack, Adam Schiff said, "We saw Grassley, the senior Republican on the Judiciary Committee in Iowa yesterday, unable to condemn the president's effort to get the Justice Department to overturn the election." Referring to Steve Scalise of Louisiana, the House Republican whip, Adam Schiff pointed to another Republican leader unable to acknowledge that the election wasn't stolen. On Fox News Sunday, Steve Scalise refused three times to say if he believed the election was stolen. "If these personal capitulations that are putting our country at risk," Adam Schiff said, adding that the Republican Party is now an autocratic cult around Donald Trump, not interested in governing. Trump's Iowa rally was part of a shadow campaign. The former president remains eligible to run for the White House because enough Republican senators stayed loyal in his second impeachment trial for inciting the Capitol attack to stave off a conviction. But Trump has not formally declared a run for the White House in 2024. Speaking to NBC's Meet the Press, the Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, a Democrat, said the American people should see Donald Trump aides testify under oath. "When you consider that these were Trump appointees," Sheldon Whitehouse said, "of events before the 6th of January rally outlined in the Senate Judiciary Committee report, people who are willing to go right to the chalk line, and in my view, even over it, when those folks saw this as an outlandish and illegal and something that they don't quit before they participate in, that shows how berserk this has gotten." Referring to Jeffrey Clark, a senior Justice Department lawyer whose willingness to help Donald Trump was outlined in the Senate report, Sheldon Whitehouse said, "We then go to the further question of, okay, how was this organized? Was this really just one little guy in the Department of Justice with a wild idea? I doubt it." Observers and experts have warned of a slow-moving coup, shorthand for processes by which Republicans at state level have since 2020 moved to change voting and electoral laws and to install sympathetic officials in positions which monitor and certify elections. The former White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham, author of a tell-all book about her former boss, Donald Trump, also appeared on NBC on Sunday. Stephanie Grisham said that if Trump does run again in 2024, he'll have no guardrails because he will never have to worry about re-election, so he will do whatever he wants. He will hire whomever he wants, and I think that includes people of the 6th of January mind. Imagine who he could put into the Department of Justice in 2024, knowing he's got no consequences there. Asked if Donald Trump would destroy the democracy, Stephanie Grisham said, "I think it will be a very terrifying time. I think it will be nothing but revenge, retribution, and how he can benefit himself. There will be pardons happening. I think there will be very draconian policies that go way too far. So I believe if he is re-elected, it will be a really, really scary time."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Britain grapples with a full-blown crisis. Labour shortages, truck drivers in particular, have disrupted supply chain activities and caused several problems. The significant lack of drivers meant deliveries of fuel and food were falling short. As a result, the country witnessed panic buying of fuel and some goods dwindled. These events triggered chaotic scenes across major cities, leading to long lines at gas stations and fistfights among drivers. Also, many factories and businesses are struggling with rising energy bills. They are on the verge of halting production and closing down unless the government immediately acts on spiraling natural gas prices. In fact, the crisis has already forced a wave of collapses among energy suppliers. This is while the government is planning to impose a levy on gas bills, which could push the prices further. The British government is now under fire for its handling of the crisis. So, being under intense pressure, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson blamed the trucking industry for Britain's supply chain mess. The industry called Johnson's claims wrong and pointed to the government's immigration policy and delays in testing and certifying new drivers as the main culprits. The government also claimed there is a global shortage of drivers. However, the European countries have not faced a similar problem. Britain faces a shortfall of 100,000 drivers. 20% of those are drivers who departed Britain after the country voted to leave the European Union. In addition, about 200,000 EU citizens left Britain during the coronavirus pandemic. So, how does the British government address the crisis? By introducing a short-term visa program. But by offering short-term visas to foreign truckers, the British government is admitting that exiting the EU was a decisive factor in the current crisis. In addition, many people are reluctant to uproot themselves and move to Britain for temporary and difficult work while they have better options in EU member state countries.
It's a crisis of the free market, a triumph of the free market. The government abandoned regulation, it abandoned public ownership, so it's private ownership. So we're depending for energy in Britain on people who make lots of profits out of energy shortages. So, you know, if it's to someone's advantage to see gas and electricity prices shoot up, then they're going to go up. They're not going to say, oh, we're not going to take profits because it's bad for the economy. They're going to say, hey, send me more.
Households that spend a high proportion of their income on energy bills are considered to be in fuel poverty. Currently, 4 million people in Britain are already in fuel poverty, while up to 1.5 additional British households won't be able to afford to heat and power their homes. Last October, the government raised the energy price cap to control the sharply rising wholesale gas prices. The cap limits the impact of soaring energy prices on British households. The UK energy regulator said that the price cap must rise again next year if wholesale gas prices continue to go up. This could mean a typical customer paying between £400 and £600 more annually. That's while natural gas prices are at record highs as economies around the world begin to recover from the COVID crisis.
The government in Britain has recently cut back on the minimum payments for welfare and support for all sorts of people, from unemployed to underpaid to pensioners. So a lot of the apparatus that was very leaky, the very leaky safety net we already had in Britain has been torn up, and the government has decided that people, as a matter of conscious policy, they think that people only go to work if they're starving, so they're trying to starve people. And that includes freezing them. Freezing and starving will get them to work, is what they think.
The price rises had already pushed 500,000 more households into fuel poverty. Unable to pay heating and energy costs, these low-income families are at a great risk. Many actually die every year because they can't afford to heat their homes. In fact, 8,500 people died in England and Wales last winter due to cold homes. All in all, the British government should stop blaming others and start cleaning up the mess it is responsible for.
In another sign of growing tensions in ties between Washington and Beijing, the United States Central Intelligence Agency announced the formation of a group that would focus exclusively on China. The CIA argued in a statement that the China Mission Center aims at addressing what it called global challenges to the U.S. competitiveness posed by the People's Republic of China. According to the U.S. spy agency, those issues include emerging technologies, economic security, climate change, and health.
The real threat that China poses that the United States is referring to is the ability to undermine the empire. And we see that right now, that there's definitely a global shift going on, which is starting to move from the West towards the East, of which China is the main power in this situation.
The announcement comes amid a wider prioritization by the administration of President Joe Biden on countering Beijing. In June, Biden announced a new task force at the Pentagon to assess and respond to Beijing's military challenge. The United States and China remain at odds over several issues, including the situation in Hong Kong, U.S. relations with Taiwan, trade, commerce, and the disputed South China Sea. U.S. President Joe Biden has repeatedly vowed to re-engage with the international community, marking a departure from his predecessor Donald Trump's foreign policy. In the case of China, however, it appears that he's following in the footsteps of Donald Trump's America First stance against Beijing. Top U.S. counterintelligence officials have reportedly warned that a concerning number of CIA informants are being captured and executed. According to the New York Times, the warning came in a top-secret memo the officials issued to all of the CIA stations and bases around the world last week. The memo suggests that the agency's Counterintelligence Mission Center looked at dozens of cases in the last several years involving foreign informants who had been killed, arrested, or most likely compromised. The cable itself was not necessarily unique, but as the Times notes, announcing the specific number of killings is rare, as the information is usually kept strictly under wraps by intelligence officials.
And this has been something that was significant enough that it was leaked into the mainstream media where it was reported on. It seems the United States sees this as possibly a potential crisis and something they need to reinforce with more bodies.
According to the Times, recruiting spies has always been highly risky. However, the cable warned that the CIA has not excelled in the area recently for reasons that include being too trusting of sources, underestimating foreign intelligence agencies, and moving too quickly to recruit informants while ignoring potential risks.
It's frankly acknowledged that everybody is spying on everybody else because everybody needs to know what their competitor is doing with regards to their stance towards them and what plans they have, etc. So in this regards, the United States is not doing anything new, nothing that it has ever done before. But the main bulwark of this, the main reason this is happening, is the U.S. is trying to expand its current intelligence network.
The report says that the uptick in the compromised informants highlights the growing prowess of other countries in employing innovations like biometric scans, facial recognition, artificial intelligence, and hacking tools to track the movements of CIA officers in order to discover the sources. The memo suggested that the U.S. spy agency overestimated its capacities and underestimated its adversaries. The results show that countries targeted by U.S. espionage are becoming more capable of exposing agents than ever before.
U.S. social media giant has come under scathing attack by a former employee. The company has been accused of putting profit over everything else. Former Facebook employee Frances Hogan says that the company's sites and apps are harmful for children. She's also accused the social media platform of stoking divisions in society. 37-year-old Hogan was previously a product manager at the company. Now she's a whistleblower and has turned against Facebook. She made the accusation at a hearing in the Senate. Hogan accused Facebook of putting profit over safety and compared it to tobacco companies, arguing that a company with such frightening influence over so many people, over their deepest thoughts, feelings, and behavior, needs real oversight. She also said that if left alone, Facebook will continue to make choices that go against the common good.
If you look at the way that they filter content, if you look at the way that they censor certain topics that they'd rather not be seen, the way that they quote-unquote fact-check some of the things, the way that they delete accounts without discretion, the way that they censor people, and the way that they choose what content goes at the top of your newsfeed or shows up on your newsfeed at all through their algorithm, they really have a grip on what it is we are able to see on Facebook.
The context for the hearing were materials that she had leaked to the Wall Street Journal. According to the documents, Facebook's own studies suggest that Instagram and social media in general have a negative psychological effect on young girls. She also accused Facebook's CEO Zuckerberg of having too much power and bringing up the January 6th Capitol riot.
Facebook wants you to believe that the problems we're talking about are unsolvable. They want you to believe in false choices. They want you to believe that you must choose between a Facebook full of divisive and extreme content or losing one of the most important values our country was founded upon, free speech. That you must choose between public oversight of Facebook's choices and your personal privacy. That to be able to share fun photos of your kids with old friends, you must also be inundated with anger-driven virality. They want you to believe that this is just part of the deal.
Facebook has faced growing scrutiny and increasing calls for its regulation. Founder Mark Zuckerberg hit back, saying the latest accusations were at odds with the company's goals. In a letter to the staff, he said that many of the claims were illogical and pointed to Facebook's efforts to fight harmful content. The CEO argued that while Facebook took the initiative to create a massive research project to identify and solve certain problems, critics are merely weaponizing that work against the company to create a false narrative. Responding to Hogan's claims that Facebook's attempts to limit harmful content were constantly hampered by a shortage of staff, he said, "If we did not care about fighting harmful content, then why would we employ so many more people dedicated to this than any other company in our space, even ones larger than us?" Facebook is the world's most popular social media site. The company says it has 2.7 billion monthly active users.
So I think overall it's very detrimental to democracy because of the flow of information that is so tightly controlled through Facebook. And I also think it shows, much like tobacco companies in the past or vape companies, that they've targeted children who are in very crucial developmental stages in their lives in order to get new customers, as noted in the testimony before the Senate.
Hundreds of millions of people also use the company's other products, including WhatsApp and Instagram, but it has been criticized on several fronts, from failing to protect users' privacy to not doing enough to halt the spread of disinformation.
Facebook, as I said, can truly decide what shows up in your newsfeed, what gets attention, what is put in the spotlight, and what is suppressed. And I think that's a big problem. It doesn't matter who you're friends with or who you like or the groups you're in, etc. They can filter stuff out through including certain ads. They can bury stuff in their algorithms. They can ban or censor or suspend accounts that may or may not go against the terms of service. Sometimes it's not so clear whether or not certain users go against terms of service, but find themselves banned or suspended anyway.
The accusations against the social media giant came amid a worldwide outage of the company's platforms. The social media services went down for almost 6 hours, impacting more than 3.5 billion users worldwide. The global outage and the revelations seriously harmed the media giant's status in the world as a reliable media platform.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, led by the United States, has long been on a confrontational course with Russia. Developments on the ground on Russia's western borders and elsewhere are pointing to increasing tensions between the two sides. The Western Alliance has been moving military hardware and ground forces to Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland. The situation in Ukraine has turned into another serious bone of contention. NATO and Russia have been flexing their military muscles. The two have shown through their military drills and deployments, as well as public statements, that they are serious about pursuing their geopolitical interests in the Baltic region, the Middle East, and even in the Arctic. Meanwhile, America's ongoing efforts to complete a comprehensive missile system in Europe have further worried Moscow. Radars, warships, and long-range missile interceptors placed across Europe form components of the controversial system.
Without the Soviet Union, NATO does not need to exist, and they are clinging for dear life. They're trying to justify, to create a reason for them to be there and to continue to exist, and that's why they're constantly provoking Russia when Russia is not the Soviet Union. They are not the threat that the Soviet Union was.
As NATO expands eastward, Russia is not sitting idly by. It has adopted a set of countermeasures. For instance, Russia has used its westernmost territory, Kaliningrad, as a platform to boost its defenses. The territory is located between Poland and Lithuania on the Baltic Sea. Moscow has deployed the Iskander missiles and its S-400 air defense systems in Kaliningrad. NATO and Moscow have maintained contacts to try to minimize risks. The Russian Federation has had an observer mission to the Western Alliance. It was meant to promote cooperation in common security areas. This week, tensions between the two sides escalated once again after NATO expelled some members of the Russian mission. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that the organization expelled the 8 Russian diplomats over a rise in, quote, malign activities by Moscow. The Russian government was quick to slam NATO's decision. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said that there is an obvious inconsistency in statements by NATO representatives about their desire to normalize relations with Russia and in their actual actions. He added that such actions allow Moscow not to develop illusions about the normalization of relations. Meanwhile, chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the lower house of the Russian parliament, Leonid Slutsky, warned of asymmetric retaliatory measures. How will this latest episode of tensions between the two sides play out? NATO's relations with Moscow have largely been tied to the policies of the United States. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was usually accused of being too soft on Russia, but Joe Biden has made it clear that his administration will be tough on Moscow. In his first 100 days in office, Biden imposed two new sets of sanctions on Moscow and expelled nearly a dozen Russian diplomats from the U.S. Biden has repeated accusations of interference in U.S. elections and cyber attacks on government and businesses against Russia. Washington and Moscow were also locked in a dispute over embassy staffing, which could further sour their ties. Analysts believe that the rivalry between the Russian Federation and the West, including NATO, is too deep-rooted to be solved in any foreseeable future.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're going to continue our discussion of Imam Khomeini's views on different issues. In today's program, you'll be listening to his advice on the authorities and students of seminaries. Please stay with us. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, had explicated his views on seminaries and presented necessary warnings on the issue during his lifetime. However, This issue is the most important message to the seminaries and to religious scholars of ulama in the waning months of the imam's life. In his message, the imam called the ulama or religious scholars as the carriers and trustees of revelation, which they should strive to guide the people through the content of revelation and what has been bequeathed to us from the Prophet of Islam and his infallible progeny, blessings of God upon them. He writes in his message, "There is no doubt that the seminaries and the committed ulama throughout the history of Islam and Shi'ism have been the most important bastion of Islam against assaults and deviations. The great religious scholars or ulama of Islam have tried through their lifetimes to promote the issues of divine haram or forbidden laws and halal or permitted laws without modification. Had there not been the dear jurisprudence, it was not clear what sciences would have been sold to the masses in the name of sciences of the Quran, Islam, and Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them. The collection and preservation of the sciences of the Holy Quran and Islam, and the works and hadiths of the great Prophet, and the practices and behavior of the infallible Imams, peace be upon them, and the registration, compilation, and explication of them under the conditions that there were very little facilities and the rulers and oppressors had employed all their facilities to destroy the works of prophethood was not an easy job. Yet, thank God, today we can see the result of those efforts in the works and books such as Kutub al-Arba'ah, the four main books of Shia seminaries, and other books of the previous and future generations in the fields of jurisprudence, philosophy, mathematics, astronomy, principles of jurisprudence, hadith, history of Islam, exegesis of the Holy Quran, literature, Irfan or Gnosticism, lexicon, and all various fields of sciences. If we do not call this much effort as jihad in the way of God, then what shall we call it? Imam Khomeini continues in his message for ulama and the seminaries. As for the scientific services of seminaries, there is too much to say to the extent that it goes beyond the scope of what can be mentioned here. Thank God the seminaries are rich and innovative from the viewpoint of sources and methods of discussion and ijtihad or independent reasoning on the basis of the Holy Quran and Hadith. I do not think that there can be found a more proper way for deep and comprehensive examination of Islamic sciences than the methods of the preceding ulama. Over 1,000 years of history of research and erudition of true ulama or religious scholars of Islam bears testimony to this claim. This has nurtured the sapling of Islam to flourish. For hundreds of years, the clergy of Islam have been the support of the deprived. The downtrodden have always been satiated by the pure kosar of the teachings of great jurisprudence. Apart from their scientific and cultural struggles, which are superior to the blood of martyrs in some aspects, in every age, they have suffered hardships and bitterness in defense of their religion and patriotic sanctities. And while suffering captivity, exile, prison, imprisonment, harassment, and taunts, they have offered precious martyrs to the divine court. The martyrs of the clergy are not restricted to the martyrs of struggles and the war in Iran. Certainly, the number of anonymous martyrs of seminaries and the clergy who have lost their lives in the path of spreading the divine teachings and divine laws in the hands of mercenaries is very large. In every divine and popular uprising and revolution, the ulama or religious scholars of Islam have been the first who have been martyred. late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, continued by saying, "This does not mean that we defend all clergymen, and the dependent and sanctimonious clergy were not and are not small in number. There are people in seminaries who are active against pure Muhammadian Islam. Today, some people, through sanctimonious posture, are cutting the roots of religion, revolution, and the system in a way as if they had no other duty. The danger of this backwardness and regression is certainly not small. Dear students, should not neglect these colorful snakes for a single moment. These are the promoters of American Islam and the enemies of God's messengers." The late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, points to two key methods that are used by enemies in seminaries. The Imam said, "Once the global arrogance was disappointed at complete destruction of the clergy and seminaries, it chose two ways to strike. One was intimidation and coercion, and the other way was deception and infiltration in the contemporary decades. When the weapon of intimidation and threatening was useless, the ways of infiltration was strengthened. The first and most important move was the insinuation of the slogan of separation of religion from politics, which has unfortunately worked to some extent in seminaries and among the clergy so that interference in politics is considered as inferior to the status of the jurisprudent, and entering the arena of politics will cause the accusation of dependence on foreigners. For sure, the struggling clergy have been suffering more from infiltration. Do not think that the accusation of dependence and calumny of irreligiousness have been applied against the clergy only by foreigners. This is not so. The blows of unaware and dependent, aware clergy have been much stronger than those of the foreigners." Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, also addressed the clergy in his testimony. The Imam said, "I recommend to the seminaries, as I have repeatedly said, that in this era that the opponents of Islam and the Islamic Republic have attempted to topple Islam and try in every way to achieve this satanic goal, one of the important ways to this unholy and dangerous end is to infiltrate deviated and wicked persons in seminaries, whose great short-term danger is to scandalize the seminaries with indecent acts and deviated ethics and methods, and the very danger in long-term is to attain high positions by one or a few charlatans who ensconce themselves among the masses and strata of pure-hearted people and make them love them, and then deal a fatal blow to the Islamic seminaries and dear Islam and the country at the right moment." Dear listeners, in our next program, we shall continue our discussions today. Until then, goodbye and God bless.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Karim Abu Salim crossing, the only crossing into the Gaza Strip for import and export, is under the control of Israel. It keeps imposing restrictions on movement and trade process. The Israeli closure of Karim Abu Salim threatens the economic sector of the Gaza Strip. These threats come in light of the catastrophic economic and humanitarian conditions that the residents of the Gaza Strip have been experiencing for more than 15 years of siege and closure.
About 90% of the Palestinian economy depends on the agricultural sector that is going through many disasters these days, including the continuous wars on Gaza, especially the 2021 escalation. Repeated closures of Karim Abu Salem crossing has negatively affected all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip.
To voice their anger at Israeli restrictions, Palestinian farmers and traders gathered at Karim Abu Salem crossing, the only way for their crops to be sold in markets abroad.
We have lost our money in vain due to the Israeli restrictions. Israel is pursuing a policy aimed at destroying our economy and making us isolated from the world. We demand an urgent help to export our crops to the West Bank and abroad.
Palestinian farmers and traders also express the crossing closure as an aggressive act that reflects Israeli insistence on besieging 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
By depriving us of exporting our crops, Israel intends to create chaos in our life. This has already affected our economy and made our life harder. I don't see any promising future for my family.
In light of the Israeli closure of the only crossing in the Gaza Strip, Palestinian farmers and traders who depend on exporting crops for a living are calling on the international community to make action and stop these restrictions that cause serious financial losses. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Thousands took to the streets of Brussels on Sunday to try and apply pressure on heads of governments in the EU to be more decisive when it comes to climate change. It was the biggest protest of its kind since the coronavirus pandemic took hold in the 27-nation bloc.
There's a sense of urgency between young people, the elderly people. We are the grandparents for the climate.
There is no plan B. Actually, this is the moment to change our habits.
You are young and you change the world. And I'm here for change the world.
Droughts, fires, tornadoes and floods hit regions around the world during the summer, and scientists say fuel emissions are to blame. There was plenty of criticism handed out to EU leaders during the Brussels event.
Our politicians are don't seem to be hearing what we say.
Since the first marches, the political language has changed a bit, but not enough at all.
All these people in the street are necessary to tell politicians, be ambitious, because we're going to vote for you.
They're waiting too long. We have to agree with a lot of different countries.
Campaigners warn there will not be many more next generations if greater impetus is not applied to dealing with the crisis, particularly from big carbon emitters like the US, EU and China.
We have to work together, Europe and the whole world.
We should have been here more people to show that we all want change.
With my friends, we're studying in science. We want to fight and change the consequences of the past.
Referring to oil and gas, they chanted, "Keep it in the ground." Doing so might be unjustifiable in the context of economic growth and social inclusion, many analysts argue. That's because for decades, the richest countries have become richer through the use of fossil fuels. Now developing nations are being told not to do the same by world powers. These poorer countries are saying, fair enough, but you must compensate us financially. World leaders are being urged to tackle this very issue head on when they meet at the end of the month for a 12-day UN climate change summit in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Following the Americans' failure in Afghanistan, now the Taliban are rolling over Kabul and other cities and provinces across the nation. New messages painted on the walls in the city center are a reminder of visible changes. Our nation has, with the help of God, defeated America. One of the new Taliban slogans reads, replacing the previous colorful painting. The Afghan flag has largely been replaced with the white Islamic Emirate emblem, with money selling the new banner somewhat heavy traffic across the city.
After the Taliban takeover, I started selling the Taliban's flags and slogans. It is a good business for me. Many Taliban soldiers and their followers buy and display them on the cars, motorbikes, and houses. I make good money, and it is getting better day by day.
Another challenging change, the level of poverty is rising. Women are selling their gold to get some cash to support their families. Many have lost their jobs, with some struggling to make food for their family. Others are selling household items to make ends meet.
I've brought my household items for sale because there are no jobs. What should we do for a living? I asked the Taliban to create jobs. They must prepare the ground for us to work. Today we are selling household items. What should we do tomorrow?
The most obvious change is the presence of Taliban members themselves. The Taliban are seen roaming the city, guns flung over their shoulders. Some are wearing uniforms and some are in local clothes. And another change, many women are seen to be staying off the streets, but some are seen in longer coats and headscarves, and some in the all-covering burqa. Fewer men are seen wearing Western dress as they have switched to local clothes. The Taliban takeover changed the face of capital Kabul in many ways. The nation's already flagging economy is collapsing, and creeping chaos is in the making. It remains to be seen what future holds for the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
London is now hosting the biggest and most expensive Islamic exhibit, which focuses its entire attention to the life and legacy of the cousin and son-in-law of Islam's Holy Prophet Muhammad. The Imam Ali exhibit takes viewers on an interactive journey through the life of Ali ibn Abi Talib, whose loyal service helped create a lasting and perfect religion. Imam Ali is beloved by all Muslims across the globe. For Sunnis, he's revered as the fourth rightly guided Khalifa, but for Shias, he's the first holy Imam. This exhibit offers an exciting and unique opportunity for the community to reconnect with one of Islam's most important historical figures, but also for viewers to learn more information about the life of this character, including things which may have been forgotten historically. Run by the Legacy Group, the creators told Press TV they hoped retracing the life of Imam Ali in full will leave visitors with a renewed connection to this Islamic legend.
So we believe that Ali ibn Abi Talib is one of the most amazing characters in history. He appeals to a wide audience. He famously said that he's a person either your brother in faith or your equal in humanity. His letter to Malik al-Ashtar, which is his governor in Cairo, was referenced by the United Nations as being a reference point for the Arab leaders of the world because he was so adamant on justice, on social equality, on fair governance, on non-corruption. And his life as a leader in 4.5 years epitomized and personified that. So our appeal is to share this information with a global audience to come and visit and to see this place.
The exhibit is clearly a roaring success, with hundreds visiting each opening day. Organizers say that expansion plans are in motion, and they intend to remain open for the foreseeable future, meaning that Imam Ali's legacy continues to inspire even outside of traditional Muslim homelands. Robert Carter, London.
Yemenis have held an event in front of the As-Sala al-Kubra community hall in Yemen's capital Sana'a to commemorate the fifth anniversary of a massacre committed by the Saudi-led coalition in 2016. Participants condemned the international silence toward this brutal crime, saying when it comes to Yemen, the West continues to show its double standards. Abdusalam Amir is one of those who were present during the attack, where he got injured.
On that day, the sheikhs of the Nihim tribe and I attended to offer condolences to the Al-Rawaishan family because of our relationship with them. I was sitting there when the unexpected happened, a terrorist crime that killed and injured more than 700 of the best men of Yemen. This criminal act does not differ from the terrorist operations carried out by the coalition of aggression in all cities of Yemen over the past years, and the source of all these crimes is the extremist Wahhabi ideology led by the House of Saud.
On October 8, 2016, Saudi warplanes targeted the As-Sala al-Kubra community hall in Sana'a with at least two air-dropped munitions during a funeral